From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Saudi Arabia is going ahead with its glitzy investment forum tomorrow, despite the absence of high-profile speakers who pulled out amid the outcry over the death of Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. The kingdom says he died in a fistfight inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October the 2nd. Many people doubt that explanation. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says details of what really happened will be revealed in a speech that he will make tomorrow. Joining us now is Jane Harman, president of the Wilson Center and a former Democratic congresswoman from California. Jane Harman, welcome back. And you think the U.S. should consider new sanctions against Saudi Arabia over this?
I think condoning murder is something we should not stand for. Our foreign policy is based on values and interests, and values that we have in this country are rule of law and freedom of the press, both of which were violated in this case, I believe. And interests that we have are working with allies like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been our ally against things like Iran's malign behavior in the region. And surely Iran has been engaged through proxy terror groups in malign behavior, especially targeting Israel, but also elsewhere. I mean, Saudi Arabia claims that Iran is meddling in Yemen, and Yemen is targeting Saudi Arabia, and that's why Saudi Arabia is in Yemen. But at any rate, I don't see how condoning what happened, even though we have an incomplete picture of what happened, is in the U.S. interest. And therefore, I think that sanctions against Saudi Arabia, if we have proof that there was a murder here, are appropriate. But I also suggest that perhaps the 33-year-old crown prince has some growing up, maturing to do, and that it might make sense from the Saudi point of view. This is not something the U.S. would dictate. To have a, you know, some kind of a adult supervision there so that excesses in his behavior would stop happening. I think that would be in Saudi's interest. I think that the war in Yemen has created the largest humanitarian catastrophe mm-hmm. that we currently see. And I think that this episode, especially if there was a Saudi cover-up and plot to do this, is really shocking in every sense.
But do you think that the Trump administration, which has been watching the war in Yemen go on for years now and hasn't put the pressure on the Saudis to stop it, that this is going to change President Trump's relationship, for example, with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman?
I think the Trump administration wants Saudi Arabia as a good ally in the Middle East and also as a good trading partner. I think those are two agendas that it has. And I'm not against either agenda, but what I'm against is condoning bad behavior in order to make sure that agenda continues. I think we can do both. And is MBS the reason we have that agenda? I don't think so. I think Saudi Arabia is the reason we have that agenda. And I'm just suggesting that the Crown Prince has, it seems to me, engaged in some irresponsible behavior. Again, I don't want to accuse him of things that aren't proved, but I think that the war in Yemen, the way it has been prosecuted, has not achieved an objective that makes mm-hmm. sense in international relations. And so I'm suggesting that there probably is a more responsible way for Saudi Arabia to behave. It's in Saudi Arabia's interest, it seems to me, to have the U.S. as its partner. And it's in our interest to have Saudi Arabia as our partner. So the way forward could be facilitated by having a more responsible supervisory authority in Saudi Arabia.
I want to ask you one more thing, just on a personal note. Jamal Khashoggi was about to be a journalist scholar at the Wilson Center, where you are. What does it mean that his voice has been silenced?
Oh, it's a huge loss here. There are people currently at the Wilson Center who've known him for years. A man named David Ottaway, who headed, I believe, the Washington Post Bureau in Cairo for some years and is now a scholar here, was a personal friend of his, I believe, for 20 years, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. And we have others who knew him. His voice was important. He's been participant in some of our activities over the years. We do something called ground truth briefings, which are telephone conferences about hotspots. And when we had conferences about Saudi Arabia, he participated in those conferences because he had ground truth. He understood the place. He was a Saudi national, and he was embracing modernization of Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's the tragic irony of this. If Saudi Arabia wanted a fan club out there, and you'd think they would, he was in it. What he was not in was excessive behavior. And so he was critical where he thought MBS in particular had gone across a line. But he was a supporter. And clearly, if the evidence suggests he was targeted, the Wilson Center's broken up about it. I mean, there are people here who really will mourn this man. And as the president and CEO here, I didn't know him, but I certainly embraced the values he stood for.
It's Jane Harmon, president of the Wilson Center. Always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And let's get the latest now on that group of several thousand migrants that has made its way from Central America into Mexico. This morning, President Trump tweeted that he would start cutting off or reducing aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador for not stopping the migrants. Joining us now is Alan Gomez. He's immigration reporter for USA Today. And Alan, what's the latest? Where are these migrants now, and what conditions are they facing?
They have crossed into Mexico. They're in very, very southern Mexico right now, so they still have a very long way before they reach the southern U.S. border. But the conditions that they're in right now are very difficult. There's an estimated 5,000 of them now. This started off as a pretty small caravan starting in Honduras, but just people have been jumping on board as they've gone from country to country. And the difficulty now is that groups are offering to help them. The Red Cross is down there, but a lot of people in the caravan are worried about leaving the caravan for anything. So they're all trying to stick together, which makes it hard to find anywhere for them to stay. So they're kind of just staying out in the elements. Some of them have plastic that they're covering themselves up in overnight. But for the most part, they're just kind of trying to band together and going for and trying to find places to stay.
Now, we've seen these caravans before, earlier this year, in fact. But why is this one this large? Is it spontaneous, or are there, you know, people behind the scenes organizing this?
I think it's a bit of both. It definitely started out, these caravans, they've done these for years, quite frankly, because when you're making that long journey through Central America, it can be an incredibly dangerous thing to do. You get attacked by people along the way. I've talked to so many of these migrants who've been through these who tell me horror stories of rapes, of assaults, of robberies. And so they started these caravans several years ago as a way to protect themselves. So it was planned to a degree, but the size of this has definitely been a bit more spontaneous because they see the reports of it. They say, hey, this is my chance, and they'll run over and join the group.
Now, President Trump is putting a lot of pressure on countries like Mexico to do something about this, to stop them as they move north. Clearly, government officials from Mexico haven't been able to do that yet. Have they been trying?
There's been different levels of effort, let's say. The Central American nations, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, they tried to kind of slow them down a little bit, but Mexico now, all the focus goes to them now. So right now, Mexico is in a very difficult position. They're getting a lot of heat from people within Mexico and Central America to allow these folks to pass. But at the same time, when you have President Trump kind of hovering over you, making these threats, threatening to send the military to the border, threatening to seal the U.S. border, which would be economically disastrous for Mexico, it's a really tough position for them, and they're trying to walk that line.
And it does seem like President Trump is trying to, in a way, use this to his advantage. He's telling his Twitter followers that there are criminals and unknown Middle Easterners mixed into this group, and of course, we don't really know if there's any basis in fact for a claim like that. But do you think Democrats should be nervous about this caravan heading north just about 2 weeks before the election when the president is trying to use it to fire up his base?
When you look at the political aspect of this, yes, this group, really the timing of it has been difficult because it's injected this issue so quickly into the midterms. President Trump has not been shy at all. He's talking about it all the time. Republicans, I can tell you, I've been hearing from watching the races in the middle of America. They're talking about this Honduran caravan. There were accusations that Democratic operatives, that George Soros was behind all this, that they're paying for these caravans. caravan people, but, you know, I've also talked to some folks who say, actually, this is, it might as well have been paid for by the Republican Party, because the idea of showing these images of these folks marching towards the United States, as they put it, in trying to invade the United States, it's been on a constant loop on all sorts of conservative media. It's being used in, you know, just congressional district debates all over the country in the last few weeks. And so this is something that plays into their hands.
That said, Alan, how do you see this playing out if and when thousands of people do arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border?
Well, we'll see a lot of what's been going on, where they'll try to get in, and then it becomes a question of how quickly the U.S. can process those asylum claims and what the resolution of those cases will be.
All right. We'll be watching, and so will Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, the Philadelphia Inquirer gave its reluctant endorsement to New Jersey's Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. Menendez is facing a challenge from Republican newcomer Bob Hugin. The paper writes that this is a dismal election with bad choices, which brings us to our Senate tracker this week. Joe Hernandez has been covering this race. He's a reporter with WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Senator Menendez's trial for federal corruption ended in a mistrial last year. He's been trying to change the subject ever since. At a recent campaign event, he told voters, "This election is not about me. It's about you and our country." How has that been working out for him?
It's been a struggle for him, I think it would be fair to say. He has been struggling to break into the lead in this race. He is in the lead by, you know, some recent public polls, but it's been hard for him, and that's surprising in New Jersey, which is largely a very blue Democratic state.
Well, and Hugin has been trying to draw attention to the ethics issues associated with Menendez. Here he is on Fox News earlier this month.
We've done over 400 campaign stops already, events, meeting with New Jerseyans of every location in our state. They want change. They're embarrassed by this guy. He's, you know, he violated federal law, abused the power of his office.
Joe, despite all of that, there have been some Democrats, high-profile Democrats, who have been sticking by Menendez. Hillary Clinton was just there for a fundraising event. How would you describe the support that he has among Democrats nationally?
Nationally, he's getting some support from the party. The Senate Majority PAC just dropped several million into the race to cement Menendez's lead. And in New Jersey, Democrats largely are standing with him. You know, top leaders in the party here, Senator Cory Booker, his colleague in the Senate, they're all standing by him. And I should note that his corruption trial ended in a mistrial, so he was not found guilty by the jury. He was, however, admonished by the Senate for ethics violations. So when Bob Hugin says he was guilty of violating federal law, that's what he's referring to.
And what about Bob Hugin? He's a former executive at a biotech company that develops cancer drugs, and he's been criticized for raising prices on one cancer drug. Here's Senator Menendez speaking to USA Today.
And at the end of the day, it's a question about judgment. Whose judgment do you want sitting in the Senate fighting for you? Bob Hugin, who raised the price on cancer patients last year alone, not once, not twice, but three times for a drug that those cancer patients critically need.
Now, Hugin has blamed insurance companies for some of the costs of the drugs that his former company makes. He's called for changes in how drugs are priced. But when you look at Hugin as a candidate, he's also pro-choice. He's pro-marriage equality. Tell us more about him.
Well, it's true that his company, the company is called Celgene. They're based in New Jersey. They did raise the price of their blockbuster cancer drug Revlimid. They doubled it in less than a decade. Hugin would say that many patients, a vast majority of patients, didn't actually see that price increase when it came to their bills because it's got to go through insurance companies and all that. But the price of the drug did go up. Celgene has also, you know, settled a lawsuit from a whistleblower who said that the company was advertising drugs for causes that weren't approved by the FDA. But you're right that Hugin is trying to run a moderate Republican campaign. He's pro-choice. He's been talking a lot about women and the equity of pay for women. But he is also tied to Donald Trump. He spent $100,000 on the campaign to elect Donald Trump. He went to the Republican convention. So, you know, he doesn't have a voting record for people or journalists to look at. He's a first-time political candidate. But he has supported Trump and the Republican Party in the past.
From the voters you're speaking with, with. How much is Trump a factor compared with Menendez's ethics issues?
Yeah, you would think Trump was on the ballot this year because people keep talking about him. It keeps coming up in my conversations with people. But so do Menendez's ethics issues. And for a lot of people, they see, you know, Hugin tied to Trump and Menendez tied to his trial. And they're trying to decide on the lesser of two evils. That is, you know, the calculus for many people in New Jersey this year.
It's been a long time since New Jersey had a competitive Senate election.
Yeah. You know, it's been about 40 years since the state elected a Republican to the Senate. New Jersey is pretty reliably Democratic in that way. I mean, you know, we had Republican Governor Chris Christie for 8 years. New Jersey is quite blue when you look at, you know, voter registration and things like that. However, these races do happen. You know, New Jersey often does elect a Republican and re-elects them for a long time. Republican Congressman Frank Lobiondo is retiring this year after decades in Congress. So it does happen, but it's surprising. This race, it's surprising how close it is because of Menendez's support in the party and just his, you know, popularity previously.
That is Joe Hernandez of WHYY talking about the Senate election in New Jersey. Joe, thank you.
You got it.
Well, a note now that our next story might not be appropriate for all listeners. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of boxes of rape evidence are sitting on shelves at police agencies across the country awaiting DNA testing. DNA evidence can help identify sex offenders by matching their DNA with a federal database. Some state legislatures are trying to reduce the backlog, including Washington State. But as Anna Boyko-Wyrock of member station KUOW reports, progress is slow.
The Washington State Patrol, the state's police agency, estimates there are between 8,000 and 10,000 rape kits that haven't been tested.
Every one of those represents a survivor whose voice wasn't heard, who didn't have justice, and also potentially very dangerous offender still on the streets.
That's State Representative Tina Orwall. A few years ago, she sponsored a bill that passed the legislature. It required that every kit be tested. It didn't solve the problem. Now, there's a bottleneck at the state crime lab. Recently, in Seattle and the city of Tumwater, two cases emerged of men who continued raping women as their DNA sat in the testing queue. That's increased the urgency to fix this problem.
We're looking at how other labs, like in Ohio, have been able to process them more quickly.
This year, Ohio was able to nearly eliminate its backlog, around 14,000 rape kits. At the crime lab in rural central Ohio, the rooms are set up like well-equipped high school chemistry labs along narrow corridors.
So this, again, this is the biology lab.
DNA laboratory supervisor Kristen Slaper stands in front of the room's glass window. On the other side, a scientist is testing a rape kit.
You can see the white box that's close to the windowsill with the paper bags.
Rape kits are smaller than a shoebox. They're filled with materials and Q-tip-like swabs of body fluids collected by a nurse after a rape. At this lab, robots help test those samples for DNA.
These are our robots.
They have names like ABI 9700 and TCAN. The robots do three times the work of one scientist. They're key to the lab's efficiency. So is another word you might be unfamiliar with.
Kaizen.
Slaper explains that they basically did a hackathon using a Japanese productivity philosophy called Kaizen. Rape kit testing follows something like an assembly line, and the idea was to examine each step to make it more efficient. Slaper says it worked.
It used to be that it could take a scientist a day, an entire day, to work a rape kit. Now it can take an hour, 2 hours, for them to open it, do minimal screening, take their notes, and cut the samples into tubes, and then move it along to the next step.
The Ohio labs were essential in providing evidence for many sexual assault cases. Testing the kits helped uncover 300 serial rapists and solve over 1,000 crimes, including the case of Liz Garcia. Garcia was raped at home in Cleveland in 2004.
I was looking in the mirror. I was like, oh, I did a really good job with my hair this morning. Then I noticed that the door was opening, so that's when I turned my attention to the door.
A stranger in a ski mask walked in, choked her, and raped her. Over a decade later, that man is now in prison for life without parole. DNA testing helped link him to the rapes of 21 women. Garcia says getting justice helped her move forward.
Those kids sitting on shelves do nothing for us women, in the process of our healing. We have to know whether the assailant is caught. We have to get our chance in court to face them.
Rape kits in Ohio are tested and out the door in less than a month. But in Washington state, it can take around a year and a half to test one rape kit. Jean Johnston is a crime lab manager with the Washington State Patrol. She says the labs are in a tough spot.
There's just an increase in the demand for service, so it's hard to keep pace with that.
After the state law passed in 2015 requiring DNA testing on all rape kits, Washington made some changes. The state now processes rape kits from active investigations and sends the old, untested ones to a private lab in Utah. But that doesn't really solve the backlog problem either. The Washington lab still has to look over the private lab's work.
We also only have a limited amount of resources of fully qualified DNA staff that can actually do the review of the data that they've sent back.
The lab is hiring more scientists, but it takes 2 years to train them. This slow pace is not good enough for some.
I just would like to apologize.
State Representative Tina Orwell helps lead state efforts to reduce the rape kit backlog.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The system broke down. We really failed a lot of people who had a horrible, traumatic experience. And I just want listeners to know that we're committed to fixing it.
Orwell recently toured the Ohio crime labs with members of Washington's lab. She hopes Washington State can learn from Ohio. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
File this next story in the category of I wish it would happen to me, but it never will. The $1.6 billion Mega Millions jackpot is still without a winner, and so is the $620 million Powerball prize. The next drawings are Tuesday and Wednesday, respectively, so you can keep the hope alive a little longer, I guess. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
First of all, let's get this question off the table. How many tickets did you buy last week?
You know, I bought zero.
Really?
Which means that my odds of winning were exactly zero.
You will not win.
Yeah, exactly. But I am going to buy some this week because you know what? I like the idea that, no, this is not my financial plan. It is not my retirement plan. It is a moment where I can have a little space to just imagine. It is
dream.
A dream. Yeah. It's a couple of bucks to dream. That's it.
It's fun. It's also historic. A prize has never been this big before. So why has it been so high?
You know, the lottery officials, both at the Mega Millions and Powerball, were tinkering with the odds a few years ago, and they wanted to lessen the chance of winning a jackpot. So that, in turn, increases the opportunity for prizes to get to really big levels. And then as the money grows to those high figures, then more people get in and they want to get part of the action. But of course, you know, the odds are terrible.
They're more than terrible, Jill.
They are.
Let's just say them because they're fun. The odds of winning the Mega Millions, 1 in 302 million. Now, the odds of becoming the president of the United States, 1 in 10 million. The odds of reaching sainthood, 1 in 20 million.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, the odds for a Jewish woman to become a saint is definitely zero. So I think that my odds are better to win the lottery. Okay. Here's some more fun ones. Will you do this just for 1 second?
It's
fun because I'm a geek about numbers. My favorite one, the odds of dating a supermodel is 88,000 to 1.
Well, that's
I don't know how
good.
They figured that out. That's not bad.
That's pretty good.
You know, odds of getting attacked by a shark are like, you know, 1 in 4 million or so. And you will get struck by lightning more often than you think. 1 in 114,000 and odds of dying dying in an airplane crash, one in 200,000. Huh. So I think what we're saying is the odds are long, but who cares? It's fun.
Who cares? It's fun. And somebody's going to win, right? You were a financial planner at one point, and you had a lottery winner as a client. Blessing or a curse for that person?
Complete blessing. I mean, it was a curse because it was hard to manage it. But like really in the world at large, these two people came into my office in Providence, Rhode Island. They interviewed me and they said, oh, you know, we've come into some money. And I conducted the interview as I always do. And at the end of the interview, they said, well, we should tell you it wasn't, because I said, what was the inheritance? And they said, oh, it wasn't an inheritance. I hit the lottery. I said, oh, how much, in my jaundiced way? And they said $80 million. And I almost fell off my chair.
Yeah.
Anyway, they conducted the interview that way. They wanted to see what kind of human being I was, how I treated other people before they hired me.
Real quickly, I know a lot of people right now are getting their office pools together. We did it. The Here and Now office pool won all of $2.
Mm.
So we're going to fight over those 16 cents. But one of the rules I've heard is put it down in writing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You can put it down in writing and, you know, be careful who you go into a pool with. And also, obviously, if you do win, you do want to kind of keep it under wraps as long as you can, because you don't want everybody to know.
Yeah. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Good luck, Jill. You're going to need it.
I know. Thank you.
We hear a lot about the millennial generation, people born between the early 80s and the mid-90s. The generation that follows has a few names, including Generation Z and the I generation. These are people born between the mid-90s and 2012-ish. The I generation alludes to the fact that this generation has been connected to the internet since birth. By 2020, Generation Z will make up about a third of the U.S. population and will be more diverse than any previous generation. So what do we know about them? Joining us now is Gene Twenge, who is the author of the book iGen and a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Tell me, what defines this generation?
So iGen spends a lot more time online and on digital media than previous generations did. So that means they have less time for other things. So they spend less time interacting with their friends in person. They spend less time sleeping. And perhaps because of those trends, they also are experiencing a much higher rate of anxiety and depression and self-harm behaviors like cutting compared to teens just 5 or 10 years ago.
And this is the generation also that grew up, either they weren't born when 9/11 happened or they were very young when 9/11 happened, which makes them very different than the millennial generation.
Yes, although I don't think 9/11 is the main reason for that. I think the Great Recession, as well as the growth of the use of the smartphone, are the two big events, you know, that really produce the bigger differences. And the really big shift between millennials and iGen is in optimism and high expectations and self-esteem. Millennials are a very confident generation with very high expectations, very optimistic, and iGen really is not. Those trends that have been building for decades toward more positivity, more optimism, really turned around with iGen. They're a much more pessimistic generations, not as confident in themselves.
Is that comparable to any other generation that we've had in history?
Well, that sudden shift between millennials and iGen is unusual. I've been doing work on generational differences for a long time, and the transitions between, say, boomers and Gen Xers and millennials were not as stark as this much more sudden shift between millennials and iGen.
And what is the reason for that? Is that just because of the Great Recession, or why would they be so pessimistic?
Well, I think with some variables, it's the Great Recession. For most of them, the trend turns around at about 2011 or 2012. That's when the smartphone gained market saturation, when the percentage of Americans who owned a smartphone crossed 50%. So I think that is probably at the root of it, that when the smartphone became common, then teen social life really shifted. It shifted online and then away from in-person social interaction.
Now, let's talk about the smartphones for a second, because we've all become addicted to our smartphones, no matter what generation we're in. What difference does it make that these people in iGen or Generation Z are so young when that's happening?
Yeah, and certainly the smartphone has had an impact of people across many generations and many age groups. But I think it has had the biggest impact on this generation who's never known it any other way. Mm-hmm. Many iGeners can't even remember a time before the smartphone existed. And that's a time when social life is very important, where teens are forming their identity, when what really shapes them a lot of times is the time that they spend with their friends. And how they spend the time with their friends has fundamentally shifted to go online, social media, and texting, and away from hanging out with each other in person.
Do you see people in this generation who shun this way of life, who decide that they don't want to be on their phones all the time, even though they've never known any other way?
Well, there is certainly awareness that a lot of times they are spending too much time on their phones. They will, in their own words, often describe themselves as addicted. But 95% of teens have a smartphone now. And it has become normative to spend hours and hours a day on the phone, to always respond to your friend's text instantly, to want to be the first to post the like on the Instagram post. Mm-hmm. So it's a real cultural norm that's shifted.
Another thing that is different about this generation, we've been hearing that the generations are becoming more diverse in this country, but Generation Z or iGen is actually even more diverse than the millennial generation.
Yeah, absolutely. So they are the most diverse generation in American history. And that's reflected in these big surveys that I work with, where they're asked about their experiences with people from different backgrounds. So say high school students, of course, because the high schools they go to are more diverse, much more likely to have friends of other races and ethnicities, to hang out with people from different backgrounds. That's definitely more common among iGen than it was just, say, 10 years ago with the millennials.
We mentioned 9/11. How do you think U.S. foreign policy has shaped this generation?
Well, that's hard to tell from the data that we have, because foreign policy arguably has changed the most in the last few years with the Trump administration, and we don't have that survey data yet.
But the U.S. has been at war for the entire lives of many of these people.
True, but because there's not a draft,
right,
that hasn't had a direct effect on the majority of the country.
How are companies marketing to this generation in a different way than they have to the millennials, for example?
Yeah, they do have to market to this generation differently because there's such that big generational shift. I think a lot of them are picking up on the same trends that show up in these big surveys, such as iGen is really interested in safety. That's not something you usually associate with teens and young adults, but in their conversation and what they say in their attitudes and in their behaviors, they're very interested in physical safety and what they call emotional safety. And I think that's something companies are starting to pick up on. And I think as well that there's a lot more awareness around stress and anxiety that companies are realizing is another theme with this group.
So we're just a couple weeks away from the midterm elections. Do you think that many of these potential voters will actually vote, Generation Z people?
I wish I could say yes. But statistics from past elections and what they say about their attitudes toward getting involved in politics and government and voting are not encouraging. So in these big surveys, 18-year-olds are now less likely to say that they're interested in government or social issues or politics than teens were, say, 20 years ago.
Why do you think
that is? Well, I think because there's so many other things to do. There's always the possibility of something new to see on social media, or a new game to play, or a new series to watch on Netflix. And I think especially I saw that in some of the interviews that I did, a lot of teens, said, well, we have all these other things to do. Why would we pay attention to the news? I only do that if I have to do that for a class, was a very common response that I heard.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, I've had many conversations with people who are in this generation, and I always find that, yes, they are definitely more reliant on their phones, their mobile devices, the internet in general. But they're also often really smart. I'm quite impressed sometimes when I speak with them.
Oh, absolutely. They're definitely smart. I mean, they've had access to all of this information, and they're quick thinkers. There's actually data showing that IQ has gone up over the generations. So I think, yeah, smarts is definitely not the issue.
So obviously, Generation Z is going to have to deal with some of these problems on their own as they get older, and even right now. What can those of us in the other generations do to assist in any way with some of the problems of this generation?
Well, I think we do need to be aware just how severe the mental health crisis is right now among teens and young adults. So there's a little awareness around that, but not half as much as there should be, that we're seeing unprecedented levels of depression and self-harm among teens and young adults now. And we need to have more resources and more awareness of the causes behind that, and then more funding and awareness for treatment.
That's Jean Twenge, who is professor of psychology at San Diego State University and author of iGen. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, is in Moscow for 2 days of talks with top Russian officials. And the meetings could be tense. On Saturday, the president said he's pulling the U.S. out of the Cold War-era Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, also known as the INF. Republican Senator Rand Paul responded on Fox News Sunday.
I think what we should do instead of getting out of it is I've asked the president, and I've advised him privately and in public, that he should appoint nuclear negotiators, nuclear arms control negotiators, to actually work with the Soviets. We have complaints that they're not in compliance. They also have complaints that some of our missile launchers in Europe are not in compliance. Let's have a rational discussion with experts on this and see if we can resolve it.
Both the U.S. and Russia deny accusations that they violated the treaty, which was signed in 1987 during the Reagan administration. It banned the U.S. and the then Soviet Union from having ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles with a range of 300 to 3,000 miles. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us now from Moscow. And Sarah, tell us more about how the Kremlin is responding.
Well, the prime response has been to warn that this is a very dangerous step and that it makes the world a more dangerous place. Basically, the Kremlin's been pointing to the fact that if the US pulls out of this treaty unilaterally, essentially rips it up, then that means, as Moscow sees it, that the US will and intends to develop that particular category of mid-range nuclear missiles that were banned, and therefore Russia will have to do exactly the same in order to maintain parity. So it is a return to the arms race of old, is what Moscow is warning and saying that threatens the stability of the world order, essentially. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, the point is that Russia is trying to argue, trying to keep, I think, the moral high ground in this. It's arguing that it has done nothing wrong and that by withdrawing from the treaty, it is the United States that destabilizes the situation. But I think that's interesting because, of course, there are critics of the treaty here in Russia itself who've long argued that it basically ties Russia's hands and allows other countries, for example, China, to go ahead with missile development and increasing their nuclear arsenals. And perhaps, in fact, there are plenty of people here in Russia who'd be quite happy to see this treaty gone, but even more happy to be able to blame that on the United States.
And President Trump has complained that China is not a part of this pact. Do you think that this could be some sort of strategy to make a new deal with the three countries?
Well, certainly it does beg that question, doesn't it? I'm not entirely sure, and certainly the experts that we've been talking to suggest that actually it might be a really long shot to try to renegotiate this treaty. But I think that the sort of the language that's coming from the Kremlin is interesting. It does seem to suggest that Moscow is exploring the room for compromise on this, because the line that we're hearing from the foreign ministry and from the Kremlin is that Russia has seen no actions yet by the United States, simply a statement of intent by Donald Trump. And in fact, withdrawing from the treaty itself is a process which takes some 6 months. So I think Russia's saying, look, we're ready to hear what you're saying. We're ready to discuss this. We're ready to try to play the responsible actors in this, at least to keep that guise. And let's talk. Let's see where this can go. Because I do think that Russia and the United States both have shared concerns about Chinese nuclear development. And whether or not there's any kind of wiggle room in there for some sort of broader deal, I think is a big question at this point.
Now, it's very interesting. Mikhail Gorbachev, the former president of the Soviet Union who signed the deal with Ronald Reagan, has criticized President Trump's decision. He said, do they not really understand in Washington what this can lead to, which refers back to what you've been saying. The response has been in Russia that this is a dangerous step for world order. But what has the legacy of this treaty been in Russia? Have Russians been accepting of it over the years?
Well, it essentially wiped out an entire class of missiles. And of course, the Soviet Union had to destroy a lot more of them than the US had to do. It was and it is and it remains a key part of the security architecture post-Cold War. So I think, you know, Russia and the rest of the world have been the beneficiaries of that. But of course, you know, in recent months and years, Russia has been keen to stress that it is developing its nuclear arsenal, that it is back, if you like, on the world stage as a nuclear player again. Part of President Putin's kind of positioning of Russia as the one who's inherited the Soviet legacy. So President Putin sees Russia as a superpower, rather like the Soviet Union used to be. So part of that is maintaining a nuclear arsenal. And so we've seen, for example, back in March, he made a speech where he sort of paraded all these long-range nuclear missiles that Russia is working on. And that was a big deal for Vladimir Putin. So I think, you know, Russia wants to be a global nuclear power. It wants to be reckoned with more broadly. And I think the bigger question is whether if there is a renewed arms race and whether mid-range missiles come back into play, you know, can Russia match its kind of rhetoric with its checkbook? You know, does it have the money to fund the kind of arms race that potentially we could be talking about?
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.